from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 2 days after Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko attended a massive candlelight vigil for peace in the capital city of Kiev, his government began a massive military draft. Expected to add 100,000 soldiers to the armed forces this year, the first of 3 stages of the draft started Tuesday and will seek 50,000 recruits. 2 more stages are scheduled to follow in April and June. Vladimir Talalay, a spokesperson for the Joint Staff, warned that those dodging the draft could face up to 5 years behind bars, but that threat hasn't prevented Ukrainians from venting anger at the draft online. Last year saw 3 waves of conscription in Ukraine, with each one accompanied by massive protests from the draftees' families. The draft comes into effect as Ukrainian troops continue the massive assault on the east, which started Sunday. On Monday, 2 people died as a result of shelling in the city of Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. Tuesday morning, there were reports that the army resumed rocket fire on the town of Gorlovka, just outside Donetsk. Among the targets struck by the Ukrainian army's attacks were a hospital and a kindergarten. RT's Roman Kosarev filed this report from the ground in Donetsk.
Around 10:30 on Tuesday morning, a kindergarten was hit in Donetsk by Ukrainian army shelling. The kindergarten is located about 2 kilometers away from me. I'm not sure if you can hear right now, but there are sounds of the cannonade coming from the airport now as well. Now, besides the kindergarten, emergencies ministry station was also hit today, and that's the place where rescuers are leaving from to put out fires and take care of all the consequences as the result of of shelling in the residential areas. All in all, the fighting has not really stopped. We are in a full-scale war as fighting continues along the entire front line. On Monday, Children's Hospital was hit here in Donetsk. It's located about 500 to 600 meters from our hotel. And a doctor was wounded. 5 patients received concussions. And all throughout the night, Monday going on Tuesday, it was really loud here in Donetsk as shells were landing in residential areas as well as in the center of the city. As the result of that, many apartment buildings are now without electricity as well as without any central heating. The emergencies ministry are now trying to take care of that as soon as possible and get the residents to back connected back to electricity, hot water, and electricity and hot water. Meanwhile, the OSCE, who are monitoring the conflict here in the east of Ukraine, are urging all sides to stop fighting, and they're also urging to stop the killing of innocent civilians. And speaking of that, 2 people have died in Donetsk overnight, and all in all, in the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, 5 people have been killed, according to the latest information, and dozens have been wounded. Of course, this information will be updated as the fighting continues, as I can hear it right now.
The unrest in Ukraine is one example of the fighting around the world, which some experts say carries part of the blame for the poor economic outlook around the globe, with estimates now down from the last quarter of 2014, despite the sharp fall in oil prices. Besides global tensions, they say, austerity and deflation also take at least part of the blame, according to the UN's top trade and development experts. Daniel Johnson reports from the United Nations.
Geopolitical tensions such as fighting in Ukraine and deflation are just 2 of the major risks to global growth in 2015 and beyond, UN economists warned Monday. In a new report on the state of the world's economy and prospects for the next 2 years, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development said there was only moderate and uneven growth of 2.6% in 2014. It anticipates global economic growth of 3.1% in 2015 and 3.3% in 2016. Austerity measures introduced too soon in developed countries after the global economic crisis in 2008 continue to weigh on growth but are only part of the problem. Here's UNCTAD senior economist José Palacín.
In 2010, many countries shifted towards fiscal austerity. That was premature, we said, and that was harmful. This remains the case, but as fiscal austerity itself has receded to some extent, the problem is not that serious. What is missing is fiscal stimulus now.
Is there one single thing that you can say is going to impact adversely or positively on the world economy moving forward?
There are two issues I would like there to mention. One is geopolitical tensions. I think political factors are having a stronger influence in the period ahead, and they are going to cloud economic projections.
Is that because of the effect of the energy question, which is related to the geopolitical problems in Ukraine and Russia? Is that what you're referring to?
I think it goes beyond the region of the CIS. I think in other parts of the world there are also potential for tensions that may be damaging for economic growth.
Can you give me some examples?
For example, the tensions that are related to energy prices, that's going to create winners and losers. So in the losing side, there will be also a potential for tensions there.
Global inflation remains subdued, but deflation is really the big risk. Can you explain why you say that some inflation isn't a bad thing?
Inflation is not a bad thing if it comes in moderate doses. Inflation makes easier to pay debts, and we have a problem in the global economy of huge debt levels. So that facilitates life for debtors. Also, a little bit of inflation facilitates rebalancing prices in an easier way. So that's a good thing. It creates also some market power for companies. They find it easier to come to the market and sell their products and keep profits. So it's a bit of oil that greases the economy. By contrast, deflation makes debts harder to pay, leads to consumers postponing their purchasing decisions. So that's not something you would like to have on a persistent way. Having said that, one thing is having declines in prices for a short period of time. The other one is to have a situation where you have entrenched deflationary expectations. And the second one is the worrying one.
The UN report added that there's a risk of Japan-style deflation in the eurozone, although the trend of a weakening euro against the dollar was a good thing for EU countries. The US economy, meanwhile, is expected to see a 2.8% rise in GDP this year and a 3.1% increase in 2016. Elsewhere, large developing economies in Latin America and the Commonwealth of Independent States saw a sharp deceleration in growth in 2014, UNCTAD said. In contrast, East Asia, including China, saw only a mild slowdown, while India drove growth in South Asia last year. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
The crystal ball at the International Monetary Fund forecasts slightly higher growth. A report released by the IMF in Beijing Tuesday predicts that global growth will show a moderate increase of 3.3% in 2014, growing to 3.5% in 2015 and 3.7% in 2016. Those IMF forecasts for 2015 and 2016 show downward revision by 0.3% for both years since the projections were issued in the October 2014 World Economic Outlook. Journalist Bruce Edwards spoke with IMF economist Olivier Blanchard about some of the factors in the report's estimates.
There are two forces going against each other. So there's one good force, which is indeed the decline in the price of oil. And for oil importers, which are, you know, most of the big advanced economies, that's definitely good news. You know, it's like a check being given to each consumer with, you know, the right to spend it. So that's good. And it makes a difference to our forecast. Unfortunately, at the same time, there's bad news. It's not a zero-sum game, but it is clearly bad news for oil exporters. And there you have to look at each country on its own. So some of the oil exporters are very rich. They have accumulated large reserves. They can withstand the price of oil at 40 or 50 for a long time. They may have to cut on spending a bit, but you know, they can do it slowly. It's tough, but not impossible. But you have countries which depend very much on the price of oil, don't have those reserves, have other problems, and these countries are going to suffer a lot. I mean, you know, if you take the case of Russia, Now, Russia already had problems earlier, even before Crimea. Then Crimea came and the sanctions and then the oil. And so this is going to be a very tough environment for Russia. You have countries where everything depends on oil, like Nigeria is a country which is going to have a tough adjustment to make. So yes, it is not good news for everybody. And for some, it is definitely bad news, yes.
The predicted slowdown in economic activity means higher unemployment is on the horizon. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
A new employment and social report has been described as familiar and not very encouraging by the Director General of the International Labor Organization, ILO. Guy Ryder says the global economy is continuing to grow at tepid rates, which has consequences for the unemployment situation. He said that is where the core of what he called the bad news resides in the report.
In the coming year, 2015, we foresee a rise of some 3 million in the global unemployment rate. More disturbing still is the fact that in the medium term, our forecasts are for continued increase in global unemployment, which would take us up to some 212 million in 2019.
Mr. Ryder added that the ILO is drawing attention to disadvantaged groups, such as young people. According to estimates, those between ages 15 to 24 are three times more likely to be unemployed than other members of the workforce. Meanwhile, there has been some improvement in countries with advanced economies, such as the U.S., Japan, and the United Kingdom. However, the report underlines the situation has deteriorated in emerging middle-income countries and developing regions, such as Latin America and the Caribbean, China and Russia. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
Meanwhile, although China has reported its slowest full-year economic expansion in 24 years, it is still steaming along at more than twice the global rate. According to data released Monday by China's National Bureau of Statistics, the country's gross domestic product growth for the year 2014 was 7.4%, down from 7.7% in the previous fiscal year. We have this report from CCTV.
According to Mr. Ma Jiantang, Commissioner of the National Bureau of Statistics, at a press conference held by State Council Information Office on China's economic performance in 2014, the Chinese economy maintains a stable growth and is undergoing structural reform in the year 2014, and a new normal is the key word there.
According to preliminary estimates, for 2014, China's GDP was 63 trillion 646.3 billion yuan. So basically, it is 63.6 trillion yuan. So that was based on a revised basis figure. And at comparable prices, it was up 7.4%. Specifically, the growth rate was 7.4% for the first quarter, 7.5% for the second quarter, 7.3% for the third quarter, and 7.3% for the fourth quarter. And in terms of different industries, the value added of the primary industry was 5,833.2 billion yuan, up 4.1%. The secondary industry was up 27,139.2 billion yuan, up 7.3% year-on-year. And the tertiary industry has a GDP of 30,673.9 billion yuan, up 8.1%. And the GDP of the fourth quarter of 2014 went up by 1.5% on a quarter-on-quarter basis.
China's GDP reached 63.3 trillion yuan in 2014, and that's a 7.4% growth based on annual basis. And what's worth mentioning is some new factors in this growth. Online retail sales, the growth rate of online retail sales reached 49.7%, and CPI is up by 2%.
The Bureau says China's GDP in 2014 reached 63.64 trillion yuan, or about 10 trillion U.S. dollars. The latest estimate of U.S. GDP for the year was about 17.4 trillion dollars. The UN Secretary General said Monday that the solution to economic and political unrest lies in sustainable and inclusive development. Ban Ki-moon, speaking at the UN Monday, discussed why inclusive development is necessary to global peace and security and pointed out that government must lead in the effort.
Our organization is built around the three pillars: peace and security, development and human rights. In dealing with the enormous and complex challenges of each, we sometimes pay little attention to their interdependence. But the founders of the United Nations well understood that if we ignore one pillar, we imperil the other two. We must break out of our silos and work together on all three areas simultaneously. All countries and all societies can benefit from sustainable and inclusive development, whether they are rich or poor, developed or developing, in conflict or at peace. There is a growing consensus that the high levels of inequality we have seen in recent decades are socially, politically, and environmentally damaging. Development that excludes part of the population can be socially corrosive. It can contribute to crime and create a sense of hopelessness and alienation, conditions that can breed extremism. Inequality can lead to the concentration of power in the hands of the few, undermining democracy, and it can lead to the unregulated exploitation of natural resources, further degrading the environment. Despite this consensus, exclusion and inequality persist. In many countries, the poor, migrants, people living with disabilities, indigenous groups, and other older people have little or no access to basic services and cannot participate in political dialogue. Discrimination against women and girls is a blatant injustice, denying them opportunities for education, health and other services, jobs and leadership positions, hindering their own development and that of their communities and societies. Social security provision is desperately inadequate around the world. More than half the world's people lack any social protection at all, no pensions, no safety net in times of illness or unemployment. Government, the private sector, and civil society must demonstrate their commitment to education, health, job creation, and other key steps. The institutions of governance and political representation are some of the most crucial determinants of inclusive development. People need effective, responsive channels for voicing their views and addressing their grievances and concerns. The United Nations system stands ready to increase its support for countries in promoting inclusive development. The Peacebuilding Commission provides coordinated international support targeted at countries emerging from conflict. The current review of the UN's peacebuilding architecture should help to make that support more robust and flexible.
Monday was the official holiday commemorating the birthday of the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King would have turned 86 on his actual birthday this past Thursday had his life not been cut short by an assassin's bullet in 1968. To mark the day, we asked former six-term member of Congress and Green Party presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney what Dr. King might see and say about the condition of things today if he were still alive.
You know, there's several things that cross my mind at this point. One is the movie Selma and the controversy around the role of Lyndon Johnson in the assassination of Dr. King. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we had a trial in December in Memphis, Tennessee, in 1999, and the jury found that the plot to kill Dr. King was hatched as a part of a conspiracy with the cooperation of the United States government. And Lyndon Johnson was the president at the time. The feeling, I don't know how I should put this, but the feeling was that Dr. King had betrayed President Johnson because President Johnson had signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, had signed the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and then Dr. King wasn't satisfied with that and moved into a new phase of resistance and justice movement, and that was with the his anti-war stance against the Vietnam War. So, you know, there was a lot of tension going on at the time because the U.S. military, industrial, Wall Street, media complex was in favor of going over to Vietnam and killing the Vietnamese people. And Dr. King opposed that. Dr. King, Nobel Peace Prize recipient, opposed that. So he basically stood his position for peace and his acceptance of the responsibility for changing domestic as well as foreign policy. He accepted that. And then, you know, stood everything on its head when he decided that he was going to oppose the Vietnam War. He had to leave his colleagues in the civil rights movement because they did not want to oppose war, which the violence at home that the Black community was experiencing as it transitioned from third class citizenship to second class citizenship, which basically is what has happened.
Right.
and then I would also add that the white community that thought that it enjoyed first class citizenship has discovered now that they are second class citizens.
That's right. Absolutely.
Subject to the police state that has been built initially with their support.
Right.
So, you know, the history is not as clear cut as the revisionists would have us believe. And that's why I think the Selma movie, which I have not yet seen, but I do want to see it, is important for sparking this conversation. You know, Lyndon Johnson was in a lot of trouble back in not 1963, but back in 1961, when one of his friends, supporters, colleagues, business associates was in trouble for corruption. And that went all the way up to the top. And this information has been borne out and has been brought out. And so Lyndon Johnson has, he not only has Vietnamese blood on his hands, and those who would like to say, okay, well, Lyndon Johnson is an innocent man in all of this, that's hardly the case when you have the kind of events that took place in 1963 and then again in 1968 with the increased militarization of the U.S. policy in Vietnam. And, of course, the situation with the drug triangle, all of that factors into a very pernicious policy that had President Johnson at its top. So we have that situation of the revisionism that is being addressed now because of the conversation that has been sparked by the movie Selma.
Yeah, let me go in there. Let me go in there for a minute, because looking at Johnson, in the aftermath of the assassination of President Kennedy in November of 1963, which was the means of ascension to the presidency for Johnson, the 1964 presidential election saw him win by a landslide. Yet in 1968, almost exclusively due to the popular discontent already with the Vietnam War, on March 31st, 1968, 4 days before King was assassinated, he announced to the nation that he was not going to run for re-election, to the shock of everyone involved. So this was a huge turn when Dr. King turned a year to the day before his assassination on the Vietnam War publicly to Johnson. This was a huge event in his political career.
Well, remember, Dr. King said, about his civil rights friends, if they want to go along with the administration, they can do that. But I have fought segregation too long to segregate my moral concerns. Right. And that's when he went and he just hit it dead on and said, you cannot, have violence perpetrated by the United States government against the Vietnamese people and expect that you're going to have peace at home. So he really hit the Johnson administration. I do believe that the Johnson administration thought that there was kind of like a deal. OK, we'll give you this at home and you give us this abroad. And, you know, I would have to say that the Clinton administration seems to have struck a similar kind of deal exercised a similar kind of rationale. Okay, we will be extremely inclusive in our domestic policy and in our cabinet appointments, in the way we attack inequality in the economy of the U.S. And that's what the Clinton administration proceeded to do. At the same time, the Clinton administration policy on Africa was as bad or maybe even worse than the George Herbert Walker Bush Africa policy. Right. So the idea of trading domestic tranquility for violence and malevolence abroad is not solely confined to the Johnson administration, I think.
Well, in fact, Glenn Ford points out that under the Obama administration, you have an even uglier phenomenon taking place, which is with the lack of leadership among, say, the Congressional Black Caucus, for example, and others, while AFRICOM was installed or is in the process of being installed in Africa, and policy towards Africa took a turn for the worse from the George W. Bush administration, even the most traditionally anti-war constituency in this country, Black America, has turned because of President Obama.
Which is extremely disconcerting for me, because I happened to travel around the world. And there was a time as a African-American, I could travel anywhere on this planet and be received with a kind of moral standing, because the world understood that Black people in the United States were not a part of the war machine and the violent face of the United States that is projected abroad. That is not the case today.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.